So air plants don't get enough love in the houseplant community. They're a really great, low maintenance, low light tolerant plant option. They're also just the most fascinating species in the world that they completely defy gravity and hang from trees. I certainly appreciate them on an even deeper level. Now that I live in Florida, when I literally go on my walks every day, I see air plants attached to trees, bark, just thriving in their natural habitats. They're whimsical, they're alien looking like. They're just such fascinating plants that I think you will love to nerd out with me about. So today in the Best of Growing Joy series, we're bringing back my dear friend Josh, the air plant man, from an episode way back in the feed. Josh is a landscape architect turned Tillandsia expert, and he is air plant obsessed. Not just caring for them, but designing really sustainable, beautiful ways to celebrate these plants with his creations. This episode is great. It's a really great beginner's guide to air plants, and I hope you leave knowing something about them that you didn't before. Without further ado, let's dive in. Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Thanks. Great to be here.
My gosh, I'm so excited to have you on the show because I think there is so much to teach and educate on air plants for my personal collection. For I know it's a hot topic that's requested by listeners. So I can't believe we got the air plant man to come on the show today.
Good to be here. And I'm very excited to chat with you about this.
So let's just dive right in. I'd love to hear a little bit just about if you always have been a green thumb or if you had parents that were a green thumb, like what was your initial connection to plants and how has that kind of developed as you've gotten older?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Absolutely no one in my family has any sort of a green thumb.
Really?
And I definitely can't point to anyone that sort of inspired me within my immediate family. But I always loved nature, enjoyed hiking and being outside. And I love collecting things, all sorts of different things, whether it was bottle caps or matchbox cars when I was a kid. And I think the first time I really started getting into plants was kind of going to the farmer's market and seeing little kind of 2-inch pots of little cacti. Getting to see all the different varieties was what really drew me in, this idea that nature kind of created these unusual variations on a theme. And as I got older, I don't think it was until college that I saw someone have some houseplants. And with my obsessive personality, that pretty quickly turned my living quarters into a jungle.
Of course.
That was in Chicago, which was a slightly more challenging growing region. But
yeah.
I actually studied philosophy as an undergraduate, so couldn't have been further from kind of the horticultural world, but ended up working at the Chicago Botanic Garden after I graduated and really discovered a love of plants there. While I was working there, a landscape architect visited and was doing a promotion for their book, and I saw all the people lining up to get signatures and realized there was a profession where you could sort of design outdoor spaces and be creative, but work with nature and people, and thought that's for me. And that led to graduate school in Tucson at the University of Arizona. And that's where I got my master's in landscape architecture. And then I've been practicing as a landscape architect for about the last 10, 15 years in Los Angeles. And while all that was happening, and I certainly love all types of plants, I noticed on a trip to Hawaii at a nursery, just the most unusual genus of plants, Tillandsia, commonly known as air plants. Right away, they're crazy forms. This, I think the first one I saw was a Tillandsia caput medusae, which means head of snakes, the translation from Latin. And they look just like they might get up and walk away. And there's something alien-like and charismatic. When I learned that there were over 600 varieties and that they didn't require any soil but could grow suspended in air, I was hooked. And that obsession grew. My first email address, I think when email first began, was airplantman
Was AOL?
It was at Hotmail. At
Hotmail, even better.
Yeah, so I went, many years passed, and it was actually after a landscape architecture project was complete, the owner said they were interested in a Talanzia wall for their kitchen. And this was an idea I'd been kicking around and finally had a client to sort of fund figuring out how it would all work. And that was our first installation. That was probably 6, 7, maybe 8 years ago. And once that was complete, I said, this is such a cool idea. It would be great to kind of share it with a wider audience. And that's how AirPlant Man, the business, sort of came about. And we manufacture products here in Los Angeles to kind of display air plants beautifully enough to enhance their natural uniqueness and making care easy, which is a really important thing that I think we'll dive into in a bit.
Totally. I'm so excited. And we'll dive also into all the amazing containers and structures that you guys build for air plants, because they're just so freaking cool. But
thank you.
Just a couple things you said that I wanted to touch on. Number one, I did a show in Tucson last year. And Tucson was, number one, very underrated city. And number two, we did a hike, Tumamoc hike. And I remember it was like the first time I'd seen cacti in real life. I just remember being so blown away by all of these cacti on these hills that were like 6, 7, 8 feet and having never had seen them growing up on the East Coast. So you got to experience that climate in Tucson. And now you live in LA where like succulents grow like grass. I'm so jealous. I feel like there are plants outdoors all the time in LA. I'm jealous of the places that you've lived. And also I can totally relate to like seeing air plants for the first time in nature and kind of marveling. Like I was in Florida this year and visiting my grandparents at their retirement complex. And I looked up and I noticed there were like hundreds of air plants in the trees. And I had had, at this point, I had had air plants in my apartment, in my houseplant collection, but I had never seen them like in real life doing their like epiphytic thing. And it was so cool.
It is just amazing. It's kind of, you get this moment of awe that nature is kind of can be so creative just in terms of finding different niches and these plants figuring out how to survive in all sorts of unusual places.
Is wild. And there is such an interesting plant. Like you said, there's such a wide variety and they really are conducive for people who live in apartments who might want to have plants, but not necessarily want to have bags of soil or pots of soil anywhere, because you can have, you know, living, growing things and not deal with like the mess of soil. Like my boyfriend likes to say, our apartment will never be without like specks of soil on the ground. It's part of its charm, you know. But if you're a little bit of a neat freak, I feel like air plants are a great option for plant parents who like live in cities and stuff.
Absolutely. That's one thing we talk to people a lot about, you know, whether it's anywhere in your apartment, but especially in a kitchen or a bathroom, you really want things to feel clean. And these plants are happiest with good air movement around them and no sort of stagnant, wet soil or any sort of medium. And so for bugs and cleanliness, they're really great. And I believe, I don't think they're officially hypoallergenic, but there are certainly a lot less aspects to them to cause any sort of allergies in people.
And are they non-toxic too?
I've gotten this question a lot. And I would say they're, you know, I get asked, are they edible? And I would say, I've not seen any that are poisonous. And I've had plenty of pets eat most varieties. But so I would say not particularly edible, but not particularly poisonous either.
Well, because that's a real issue with houseplants. And when you have babies or when you have cats or dogs, it's a huge, people bring home Diffenbachia not knowing that it can kill their cat. And then
their
cat nibbles on it. So that's a really important thing for puppy parents too. So before we dive into air plant care, I'm so curious, is your personal plant collection like thousands of air plants? Like what does your apartment look like or your house look like?
Well,
what's your personal collection?
I welcome anyone making a visit to the Los Angeles area to look us up. We do studio tours. It's a wild scene. And yes, there's thousands and thousands of air plants. And we have gigantic clusters and trees and all sorts of projects, custom installations and stuff kind of being assembled and getting shipped out. There's always new plants arriving and we get all our plants California nursery grown. And that's sort of an important thing for people to keep in mind is this plant is so easily harvested that certain species, natural populations have really been decimated. And so it's important to kind of buy them from sustainably, ideally greenhouse grown sources. And the challenge there is they're very slow growing. And so that is why it's kind of taken the greenhouse world and the nursery trade a while to sort of build up the stock to be able to do that. But so we're always getting new plants in, and then we have lots and lots in stock to sort of create these installations and to ship to customers. And it's great. I will say my apartment does not have a single living plant in it.
Really?
That is a combination because the cats eat them. And also it's sort of when our studio is right nearby in an outdoor space. So we have more than enough plants outside if you've got the luxury. And then I kind of get to take a little break from work, which is nothing but plants when I'm inside.
Oh my God, that's so funny. I guess because you're a landscape, so you do outdoors. What do you feel about gardeners who say, oh, I killed houseplants? Like, I feel like now I've gotten feedback from a couple of my gardener friends that they're like, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't do houseplants. I only do outdoor plants. Like, have you come across that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's an interesting question. I think we've all killed a few plants, whether it's inside or outside. I think it's about learning from what went wrong and improving for the next time is sort of the most important part of it. I kind of tell people a lot, if you've killed them, first step is forgive yourself, try and learn what you did wrong, and then try again. At a certain point, you might want to try something else, but there is a learning curve to all of this, and you can't be too quick to judge yourself as long as you're trying to learn. In terms of indoor versus outdoor plants, you know, there's different things to consider. So I would say that the same set of skills and knowledge that applies to outdoor gardening is related but different when you're dealing with an indoor condition. And then in general, an indoor environment is quite challenging. And that's why there's a much shorter list of plants that are good for indoor use. So it's all about keeping in mind those unique cultural requirements.
Yeah, I want to do another episode like diving in on the differences, because I think it's so interesting. There are two hypermobile, hyper-engaged like groups of people, the outdoor gardeners and the indoor gardeners. And they're kind of very separate, but like loving the same thing. I think it's very interesting.
I've never separated the two worlds. I mean, they are different, but there's no reason you can't do both.
Totally. So I just want to dive in because I feel like you are going to give us so much amazing knowledge on the topic. And I have so many questions because I myself have definitely, I think, been part of killing a couple of air plants.
Of course.
So I'd love to just kind of start with like an overarching, what exactly is an air plant? How did they like come to be? Kind of break it down like what an epiphyte is. And like the basics, and then we can kind of dive into care. But I'd love to just understand what these little alien looking like things are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And happy to share a lot of the information we've sort of gathered over the years. I will have to throw out the little disclaimer. I'm not a official biologist or horticulturalist. I'm a landscape architect and a Tillandsia obsessed person. But we have read quite widely as well. So I'm happy to kind of share a little background. And so Tillandsia is a genus within the Bromeliadaceae family. And so that includes a number of other genuses, but it's basically the bromeliad family. And so that includes pineapples and all sorts of those kind of vase-shaped plants. There's kind of more xeric or drought-tolerant ones, kind of hectias and dicheas. And then there's kind of more tropical varieties as well, freesias and others. Tillandsia is kind of one genus within that. And there are over 600 different species within it. And so it's one of the most diverse genuses in the plant world. And that's a product of the fact that they hybridize quite easily. And so you'll have two different varieties growing in the same, or two different species, I should say, growing in the same region. And occasionally they'll cross-pollinate and naturally create hybrids. And that's also led the nursery trade to really create tons and tons of unusual different hybrids. And it's very interesting. You'll have one that has maybe long curly leaves and one that has short red leaves. And then you get something that's got a little bit of both. And it's really neat to see. Another thing that I've read contributed to this kind of diversity of species is that they predominantly live in South America, Mexico, and the southern U.S., kind of Florida and Texas. That's sort of the geographical region. They're in the New World only. And they apparently over history and time, as the climate would fluctuate, populations would be joined and then separated as sort of rainfall and other environmental conditions would change. And so you would kind of have these plants have the opportunity to evolve in isolation and then the opportunity to hybridize and then become re-isolated. And all of that sort of fostered a lot of diversity. So that's kind of one of the reasons they're so interesting looking. They are one of the newest plant genuses to evolve. I think it's maybe 200,000 or maybe... I forget the exact timeline. Maybe it was as recent as 20,000, but they are one of the newer genuses to evolve. So it's kind of, I jokingly say, nature's latest and greatest. And they basically are part of this larger group that's known as epiphytes. And epiphytes refer to any plant that lives not terrestrially, not growing right out of the ground. And they can live suspended in trees, attached to a rock face, growing pretty much anywhere. But they are not parasites, meaning that they do not pull their nutrients from their host support. A tree covered in tillandsia, it might sort of weigh it down a little and block some of the leaves, but it's not sucking nutrients from the tree itself. And this brings us to the most important and exciting thing about tillandsia, is they have adapted these very specialized leaves that are covered in something called trichomes that we'll talk a little bit more about.
The trichomes
allow tillandsia to absorb water directly through the leaf surface. And then, just as importantly, once it's absorbed it, kind of seal the leaf back off and keep that water inside the leaves. And so, and that goes for nutrients as well. So they're really living on sort of the dust in the air and the dissolved minerals in the water, and really surviving on either rain or some live in regions where they only get fog. And that's another aspect, is there's ones adapted to the most harsh desert conditions and also ones that are adapted to very tropical rainforest conditions. So you'll see a wide range. And at a glance, the more gray colored ones are more desert adapted, reflecting more of that sunlight. And the ones with kind of wide, fat, green, succulent leaves are more rainforest adapted. But to go back to the trichomes, there's wonderful pictures online and in various books. But if you take a macro photo of the leaf surface, it is just the most fascinating thing in the world. And each species has slightly different variations of how these trichomes look. But what they basically are is a cell that has wings around it. If you picture almost like a plug with a ruffled edge, and that ruffled edge, when dry, kind of sticks up above the leaf and blocks the sunlight and basically prevents water from evaporating from the leaf surface.
So it pulls the water in?
Yeah. Well, at that point, you're protecting it from leaving is when it's dry. And so air plants will often have a gray, fuzzy appearance to them. Right. People might think that means that they're dead. And sometimes it does if they really are dead. But healthy ones, once dry, many of the species will have a fuzzy appearance to them. Some, like Tillandsia tectorum, look positively like snowflakes. They're amazing, just incredibly fuzzy. And there are a few varieties that have hardly any visible fuzz. Most have some degree or another, though. And that is their kind of unique strategy for sort of surviving in the air. When it rains, however, or they get wet, the trichome will lay flat along the leaf surface and allow the water to kind of absorb into the plant, coming through the center of that sort of ruffled plug, if you will.
Can I stop you and ask you a question?
Of course. Sure.
So just as someone who totally doesn't get any of this. So are the trichomes catching and absorbing the water and then laying on the leaf to then let the leaf leach the water in, or the trichomes are almost like the door that's either opening the leaf, like the door is open so the water can go in, or the door's closed so the water can't go in?
Yeah, I guess it's both. So it's, I think the entire trichome structure sort of contains the ability to absorb the water and lay flat and then be like an opening into the leaf. And then when dry, to kind of puff up and protect the water from leaving and prevent kind of desiccation and evapotranspiration through the leaf surface.
It's like pretty freaking cool.
It's amazing. And just the idea that how did nature figure this out? How much trial and error did this take? Right. Always blows my mind. And there is another layer to this. Again, all the science people should forgive me because I'm doing my best to convey what I've learned and read. But they do something called CAM photosynthesis, just C-A-M, I believe. And what that means is your traditional schedule of oxygen and CO transmission from a plant is reversed. And that means that the Tillandsia kind of absorbs all the sunlight during the day, but it doesn't actually photosynthesize it until the evening when it's cooler and not sunny out. And so the kind of gas exchange of the CO2 and the oxygen doesn't occur until evening time. And the key reason for this is it's another way to conserve water. And it's much less efficient than regular photosynthesis because something is lost in kind of the chemical process being separated. But it prevents the leaf surface from having to be open during daylight hours and allowing water to escape. And so it's just...
That's very like succulent mm-hmm. of them.
And succulents are another group that does this. Yeah. So, and you sacrifice your kind of vigorous growth in some instances.
Okay,
but,
that's why they're so slow.
And that's one of the reasons they're so slow. And one of the reasons some of them can get basketball sized or a little bigger, but you're not going to find a Tillandsia that's the size of a redwood tree. So it's just another incredible strategy. And it's really all about how can they live without sort of that root system in the ground that can sort of pull up moisture and hold it. And the Tillandsia itself, unlike a succulent, isn't storing a tremendous amount of water. The leaves are not particularly succulent. They're almost kind of more brittle feeling commonly. And so it's really got to be incredibly efficient in how it manages its water supply. So that's a little bit of science background. And I would really encourage your listeners to Google Tillandsia trichomes, and you'll get a visual that might help
yeah,
clarify
totally.
What I'm like, talking about.
I'm thinking of... Daryl from Houseplant Journal, he has like
yes.
a couple of really great time-lapse videos of the one Tillandsia that has the very visual trichomes.
That's very funny you should mention Daryl. We're actually, we've been Instagram friends and we've sent him some of our product that is often
yeah.
displayed in his Tillandsia
right.
corner.
I think that's where I found you actually, now that I'm thinking about it, because he totally has one of your...
yes, he has both. Great. He has our vessels and our frames.
Right,
so,
right.
His time lapse is a wonderful way to see that change. And he does one with Tectorum, the kind of fuzziest, most
yeah.
visible trichome species. That's just breathtaking.
Okay. So my other question is, so you were saying that that's how they get water through the trichomes. So what about the other nutrients? Are they
yeah.
actually pulling it out of the air, or they're pulling it out of what the water catches in the air, and the water is like the main way to get the nutrients in there? Do you know what I mean?
I do. Well, I'll say in cultivation, there are specialized Tillandsia fertilizers, and the way they're recommended to be applied is by a diluted mixture within your watering regimen. So that's how kind of in cultivation the fertilizer is delivered. In nature, I think it's a combination of ways that they kind of capture nutrients, whether it's kind of dust particles floating in the air that land on the leaf and also dissolves nutrients in the water. One kind of interesting fact is Tillandsia do have roots, but they are solely for gripping on to whatever they're suspended from.
Are those called aerial roots?
I don't think so, because
okay.
the roots don't actually do any role of nutrient absorption or water. They're just solely little grippers. And so when we get our Tillandsia from nurseries or growing them, they will often have kind of these clumping, ugly brown things coming out of the bottom that are the roots.
Mm-hmm.
If your Tillandsia is growing a lot of these, it's a good sign. It shows that it's happy and kind of trying to grip and stay in place. But we'll often trim them just for aesthetic reasons. And as long as you don't go too far up to the growing base of the plant, it doesn't damage them at all to remove the roots down there.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah,
I would imagine mm-hmm. because Tillandsia, even there are 600 varieties, that's mm-hmm. wild. But for the most part, there is some sort of like spiky, grippy aesthetic to them that like I would imagine is what can kind of allow them to grab on to these different trees or moss or mm-hmm. like whatever they grow on, right?
Yeah, I mean, so they reproduce in a few different ways. I would say it's typically more the roots than the foliage itself that
okay.
grips onto things, although our display products vary a little from that. We can talk about that later. But in terms of reproduction, they can reproduce in a few different ways. The first is traditional blooms, and many people don't realize that they all do have incredible flowers. Often when you buy them at a nursery or wherever, if they've kind of not been cared for very well, you might not recognize this, but they have beautiful blooms. The entire plant will do something called blushing, where it will and many of the species completely change color. So your entire plant will go from green to red. And then individual blooms come out kind of one at a time or a few at a time, but will only last a few days each. But they will open sequentially over a several week to a month period. And then the plant can turn this beautiful blushing color, particularly with bright light kind of helps to bring that on. And after that, the bloom spike will sort of create seed pods. And often these seeds have almost like a dandelion-like quality where they can catch the air, float away, and pretty much wherever they land, a tiny little tillandsia will start to grow. And the ones that are in good spots will get big and be happy, and the rest won't. And so there's the traditional kind of seed dispersal method. There's also something called pupping. And what will happen is after the plant blooms, from the base of that same plant, additional plants will start to grow. And what's incredible is over time, these can form enormous clusters or clumps that can be enormous. So I've seen ones the size of a person with hundreds and hundreds of individual plants that if you wanted to, you could break up and would all grow individually, or you can just leave them as one enormous mass.
Wow.
And in those instances, they're going to be genetically identical to the parent, whereas the seed dispersed will potentially have a mixing like a traditional flower.
Dispersal. I mean, as a plant parent, can I like propagate from that seed? I would guess air plants grow so slowly.
Really? Yes, you could. You would just need a lot of patience, as you said. And so there's years.
How would you do it?
How do you do it? So how you do it is, in the beginning, you would gather the seed and you spread it around a very fine mesh that kind of prevents it from falling or going anywhere, but allows really good air circulation. And I've seen it done where it's a mesh or almost a nylon stocking can work. And pulled taut over a container with some water underneath it. So it's not in the water, but there's kind of humidity rising off of it. And then you combine that with kind of spraying it pretty regularly. And you kind of just have to be really patient. You have to label it carefully. At least that's what the nursery growers do. And yeah, I've often when we order from nurseries or elsewhere, there'll be kind of tiny baby seedlings tucked into other plants. And I guess in the nursery, some seed pollinated and drifted around and landed on some other plant and just started growing there. And so you'll get them, they can be the size of like a pinhead, is sort of the scale you should picture. And within several years, they might be medium tiny and then eventually get to be sort of normal size. But there's quite a long lead time. I would say the benefit is people always ask me, how often do I have to prune my tillandsia? And I say, you can leave your pruning shears at home. That's not going to be an issue. But yeah, so it's they are quite slow growing.
Okay, so I have a couple of follow-up questions about pups. But I think before we do that, let's just do like a brief overview of just like Care 101.
Yes. This is what I'm excited to share with your listeners, because a lot of misinformation out of there.
I think air plants have the most varied advice on the internet.
To some credit, there is variation to a little bit of a degree based on the environment you're keeping them in. So someone in Hawaii with the windows open for someone in Sweden in winter is going to have very different care requirements. But that said, there are general rules of thumb I can share with your listeners that will get people on the right path. Okay,
cool. Please. Thank you.
So I will try to do the order of things that will kill your plant in terms of importance. We'll start with water. And so the number one misnomer is that tillandsia don't need water, that they just gather everything from the air. Again, if you lived in the tropical rainforest and the humidity was 100% all the time, maybe that would be true. But in particularly indoors, where the air conditioning and the heaters really create a very dry air, it's very desiccating and drying to the tillandsia. And so this is, back to what we were talking about before, interior plants is a tricky niche because, unfortunately, our indoor environments don't tend to be the most conducive to the plant life. And a big part of that is kind of how dry it is and the lack of sort of ambient humidity. And so what I recommend is a submerging if you're indoors, or an incredibly regular drenching. And so the number one thing people do wrong is, I just need to spray this twice with my water bottle once a month and it'll be fine, or I don't need to water it at all. Mm-hmm. That is completely insufficient. It doesn't matter what the species is. Tillandsia really need kind of a good deep watering. There are a few species that are a bit of an exception that are incredibly drought tolerant, but all of these, as long as they quickly air dry totally within 4 hours, will be fine. And so let me back up. What my top simple recommendation is, once a week for 6 to 10 hours, submerging the plant completely.
Wow.
And so I do it a lot longer than most. You could do an hour or two, but 5 or 10 minutes is not enough. Once you start to exceed the 12 to 24 hours of length of submerging, they can start to die and fall apart and kind of suffocate. But a couple hours is great and will really fully rehydrate your plant. And so that's why a good submerging, dunking, where the plant has many hours to really absorb all that water, when you remove it from the soaking container, you'll notice it's far cleaner or far better rehydrated. And the other thing is to make sure that water is clean. You don't want to use a sink or a shower if there's been lots of soaps used in there. You want kind of a clean, dedicated soaking container for them. Tap water is not ideal, but after many years of hauling around bottled water for the plants and drinking tap water for myself, I said, these plants need to just tough it up.
Number one, pet peeve. Well, my kids drink fancier water than I do.
No, I did that for many years and finally decided that these guys needed to tough it up. It's the dissolved minerals, particularly calcium and other things in our water supply, can kind of clog the leaves over time, which is why whenever it rains, and it's pretty infrequent here in LA, but I immediately make sure all my plants are outside getting wet, because that rainwater is perfectly pH balanced and has kind of less dissolved minerals in it. And so it's really, really healthy for them. The other thing to think about is chlorine. Most of our tap water is chlorinated. And so letting the water sit in an open container after you've filled it for 15 or 20 minutes allows some of the chlorine to evaporate and dissolve before you put your tillandsia in it. That said, I've put them right in and, you know, it's not the worst, but in an ideal situation, you would do that. And then the other thing is never use distilled water. So distilled water, because it has no nutrients in it, would actually suck the nutrients through osmosis out of the plant.
Interesting. And
so it's important if you're using filtered water, it's just sort of a natural mineral water, but not distilled. And if you're using tap water, room temperature, and let it sit for 15 or 20 minutes before you put your plant in it. That said, if it's not feasible to do a soaking, you can spray the plant, but the entire plant should be dripping wet. Just a little spritz isn't enough. It should look like it's just been submerged, and you'll need to do that a lot more often. And so the frequency is the other important thing. My total average rule of thumb is once a week for the soaking. If sometimes that can be 10 days or 2 weeks, sometimes it needs to be a little less, but once a week is sort of the average. If you're spraying, I would say several times a week would be ideal. So yeah, this, you know, isn't overly crazy burdensome, but it's not like a cactus or some other plant that never needs water. So it's a real misnomer that these plants do not need water. They don't need soil, but they do need water.
They do need water.
Like, and you're like every living thing. And the submerging is going to be the best way to give it a really deep rehydration, and it'll last longer between waterings. But if you prefer to spray, you can do that. You just need to make sure it's dripping wet, and you do it more often, several times a week. And so that's a complete average rule of thumb. If you're somewhere hotter, if you're in Phoenix or somewhere and they're getting blasted, then they're going to need more. But if you're in a really tropical environment, you can get away with less. And then, so that's water. The next thing that's going
to... Before we move on to that, just another person told me that it's important to let them dry upside down.
Water Thank you. Doesn't go Great in. Point.
Yeah.
Great point. Yes. You got me jumping ahead. So after not watering, another way people will often kill them is not recognizing how important it is that the plant be completely dry within 4 hours of coming out of the water. Mm-hmm. So they can basically rot and fall apart and die very easily if they don't dry out. And so the turning them upside down is particularly important in the kind of more vase-shaped varieties. Xerographica and other varieties can hold a bunch of water in their kind of center cone, which is fine if you're in the desert and that evaporates pretty quickly. But indoors, that stagnant water can sit there and all of a sudden your whole plant falls apart and dies.
Yeah.
So it's very important. often we'll say after you kind of take out your plant from its watering, you know, you could lay it on a towel or ideally put it somewhere where there's going to be some air movement, whether it's an open window or a fan, but something that will blow air over the plant and help it dry out quickly. Okay. And so, yeah, this is the, you know, it's both an opportunity and a challenge of these plants, but they like to get wet fairly often, and then they need to dry off quickly afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so that's a real challenge. And it's something that we've kind of designed into our products, whereby it's very easy to soak them and water them without handling them too much. That's another detail, is there's oils in our fingertips that kind of clog up the tollensia pores, if you will, the trichomes.
And right, so that makes sense.
A little bit of handling is fine, but if your watering method requires you to like touch the plant a ton every time you water it, which will hopefully be frequently, over time that will start to decrease its appearance. And so we like to create ways that you can do that watering without having to handle the plant. And we can talk more about that later. But yeah, that's just something else to keep in mind.
Okay, cool. And so now...
Next, right? Is light. Yes, mm-hmm. The next thing. And so we ship these plants all over the place, and we've had them sit in a box for weeks at a time. And sometimes the box will kind of come back to us for some reason or another. And amazingly, the plant will be alive after like four weeks in a dark box. So that's not an ideal condition, but it's an example of how light will take longer to have an effect. Over time, insufficient light will definitely cause your plant to become leggy and die. But it's a slower killer than bad watering. Ideally, plant will be, your tillandsia will be within 6 feet of a window.
Okay.
And they like bright filtered light, however you want to interpret that. And that would be kind of, could be full sun in the morning, more shade in the afternoon. Again, this depends, if you're by the coast, it can be more forgiving. If you're inland where the sun is really, really hot, then they can burn quite easily.
And so, if you're in what direction your apartment window is facing as well,
is going to be very important. Yeah. So if it's south or west, that's going to be much stronger than the north or east. And so that's just sort of a rule of thumb. It should definitely be getting light, though. If you're putting it in, I get people telling me they want to put it in a bathroom with no windows. It's mm-hmm. not going to work. The plants, they do photosynthesize sunlight. So they are quite adaptable to grow lights, though. They don't need any special light spectrum. So any kind of grow light will work. And so we shipped to someone in the dead of winter in Sweden, and he said they had like maybe an hour of sunlight a day or something at the time, but they put up grow lights and the plants were just fine through the dark winter. So there's some flexibility there, but yeah, so ensuring that they're getting that light. In my growing area, we have kind of a deciduous tree that kind of gives them filtered light in the heat of summer and a little bit more sun in the winter, and they're really happy. I'll also mention I had the opportunity to take a trip recently to Oaxaca with a bunch of tillandsia geeks, and we got to see all these different plants in habitat, and we saw them growing everywhere from in cactus thorns in the desert to in the jungle. Yeah, you really appreciate how hardy these plants can be in their natural environment when you see literally gripping to cactus thorns or an abujam tree, these tillandsia growing. But it's got to be, the right combination of these things. So basically, make sure they get some sunlight. And too much light can burn them, particularly if they're coming from a situation where they're used to it being really dark, and you suddenly throw them in the blazing sun, their leaves can burn. And since they grow so slowly, it's kind of difficult to recover. It'll take a very long time. So you want to be cautious if you suddenly increase the light a lot. But the more light they do get and are accustomed to, the more blooms you'll get, the more color you'll get, and the more vigorous growth you'll get over time. So that's a little bit about light. And the last thing that's actually quite, if you can manage it, is quite helpful, is air circulation. So we've done a number of installations in indoor locations where there's kind of minimal fresh air, and they can survive and they can live quite well over a long period of time, but it's not ideal. If you can crack a window, if you can have it be in an indoor-outdoor space, or even rotate it where it spends some of its time on the patio and sometimes inside, that fresh air just really reinvigorates them and makes them happier, because that's what they're sort of used to. And so that's why I would say they're definitely, a plant you can grow indoors, but you have to be mindful that you're creating a more challenging condition than they would typically have in nature just because of that stale indoor air that we all live with. And so it's yet another reason to sort of crack a window if you can, at least some of the times. And one other neat thing I'll just mention regarding the air circulation thing is there's been a few scientific studies done on these plants. And one I read about, they took tissue samples from a colony of these tillandsia growing on a chain link fence outside of Mexico City. And they basically found a level of pollutant within the leaves kind of off the charts, but the plants were still growing quite healthily. So they're probably an interesting area of research that I'd love to sort of pursue a little bit more is understanding how these plants can act as sort of air purifiers as well. I wouldn't want to falsely claim that they would compete with any of the broad leafy species, which really transpire a lot more and probably are a little more vigorous in their circulation component. But tillandsia have shown to be remarkably adept at sort of absorbing and thriving with polluted air.
They just sound like such an amazing.
They really are, and that's why I love them. It's just there's something really whimsical and tough, and in many ways, I think. Not to go off on a tangent, but a kind of metaphor for modern people and modern society, just all this incredible diversity and adaptation and sort of this ability to thrive in pretty much any niche and disconnected from the number one thing we associate plants with, which is the ground and the earth. And these plants are happiest when they're suspended in a place where they can sort of be perched and get good air circulation and water and light. And they've kind of figured out how to cut the tether to the main thing that we associated with what they are. And I just think that's a really inspiring sort of story.
Oh my gosh, I love that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about blooms.
Yes.
Because I love air plants. I've probably had 10. I think I've killed three, or three have died on me. But the other ones are doing great. But one thing that I've noticed, so number one, I've been told that once the air plant blooms, it will then die. So number one, is that true? And number two, when you're in the store, is it better to buy a plant that isn't blooming? Because now I'm kind of like, well, if the plant is in bloom when I'm buying it, does that mean it's going to have a shorter lifespan? Because the second follow-up question I have to that is, the ones that I have bought that have been in bloom, none of them have made pups. So is there a way to like force pups? And like, what am I doing wrong that none of my air plants?
No, it's a really good question. So many of them will, the mother plant, we call it, will die, and then the pups will take its place. We'll follow up on why you're not getting any pups. That isn't true in every instance. And there is a third, much rarer kind of reproduction that some of the plants do, where a new plant actually grows out of the end of the flower stalk and it forms almost a daisy chain. So you can have several generations kind of all linked together. Yeah,
cool.
But yeah, that is a really good thing to keep in mind, is if you're selecting a plant in bloom, it's not going to necessarily last as long. In terms of why you're not getting those pups, that's sort of an interesting question. I believe I almost always see pups form, so I'm not sure exactly what's going on there.
It's so interesting because I have them under a grow light or definitely within 5 feet of my window. I water them. I was told to water them for an hour. I soak them for an hour once a week. So maybe I need to up
an hour's water. An hour's pretty good, I'll say, but a little more won't hurt.
Yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, for some reason, I always look for pups.
Yeah. People love the pups for some reason, especially kids, whenever we do. It kind of talks. The kids are always obsessed with the pups. Another little detail, though, is when you're submerging your plant, always ensure that the bloom spike and the flowers are not underwater. So that will actually cause them to rot and fall apart during that.
I definitely have. So that might be why they're not.
Yeah, that might be it. It's a good rule of thumb always when the plant is blooming to try and, maybe you put it in a little shallower bowl or whatever, but try to make sure that the flower spike and the blooms in particular, especially, are out of the water. If you kind of submerge a plant that's in bud or bloom, it won't kill the plant, but it will kill the bloom spike and the flowers. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. Good, Good questions. You've definitely thought about this.
No, because I love them, but I have noticed these couple things now that I've had them for like 8 months. Yeah, totally. But I definitely have soaked
them. Yeah, it's and I will just mention in terms of lifespan, I get that question a lot, is how long will these last? And my quick answer is always, if you do everything wrong, about 6 weeks or 2 months. And if you do everything right, indefinitely. So these plants will just keep growing and living. And we've had quite a few that started as a single plant and are now kind of 8 or 10 plant clumps after a few seasons of blooming. Wow. And they're quite happy.
And if I wanted, so when I finally do get my air plant to grow a pup and it grows, what's the practice for separating the pup if I want to, or if the mother plant dies? Sure. And the pup.
And so you want to sort of follow the plant down to its base as close to, you kind of want to find that exact connection point between the mother plant and the pup. And you sort of wiggle your fingertips down so you kind of get right to that spot. And then you sort of start to wiggle the plant back and forth. And it should just sort of naturally separate. You might need to do a little snap at the end. But the goal is to not sort of break the kind of very key growing part of the plant, is both where the leaves are emerging, but then at that base, the base of the plant, there is a kind of growing core that if you snap off or cut into can damage the plant. So if you kind of just gently pull them apart, it sort of becomes clear where they're connected. And right at that connection point is where it's best to sort of separate them, kind of holding both the mother plant and the pup in your fingertips. Kind of just gently kind of pull it back until they come apart.
And then two other questions I had. One was, I believe you mentioned fertilizer. Yes. Is it necessary and how? And then also, I'm wondering, I feel like the Zero Graphica is the like sexy air plant that like everybody Instagrams, and they're so big and they're way more expensive than the other ones. So if you have any thoughts on specific Zero Graphica things, I'm sure that there are
absolutely fertilizers. There is specialized Tillandsia fertilizer. If you kind of look online, you'll see it's available. In my experience, I've had more problems than help come out of it. So certainly it's widely used and it's fine to use it if you like. You just have to very carefully follow the directions and be very cautious about over-fertilizing. You always it needs to be a very dilute mixture, or you can easily burn the plant. It's, you know, as we discussed, it's not a plant sort of used to lots of nutrients coming its way. It's used to surviving on very few. And so boosting that can boost blooms and growth, but it can just as easily kill it if you do it wrong. And so after a few mishaps, I said, you know, I think I'm fine with the way it is. And so in no way is it required in my experience, but it can give it a boost if you're interested in that. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Zero Graphica, because although there are hundreds of different species, there are certain ones which have really kind of caught on. And unfortunately, you know, Zero Graphica is one of the species I mentioned that does suffer from overcollection in the wild. And so it's become protected because people just went out and gathered them up and, you know, by the bushel and shipped them out. And a lot of native populations have really been decimated, particularly of Zero Graphica. So one thing I'd say is, as much as possible, try to track the source of, track the source to ensure that it's sustainably grown. And that can be more or less challenging. But if you can learn what nursery is propagating them, and they are widely grown in greenhouses, it just takes a little longer. And that's another reason why the cost will go up. But they're absolutely beautiful. They're very tough in that they're desert adapted, so they can take less water, more light. And if they're in a bad situation, it takes longer for you to notice because they're so resilient. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's something just so dramatic about them. But there are many, many other species that have a similar level of drama and look that are maybe less commonly seen on the shelves in the store. But if you kind of order from different nurseries online, you can see less expensive, similar looking.
That's an interesting question. So for the listeners who maybe already have a Zero Graphica, or like for me who already have the 5 basic air plants that I buy at the nursery, like what would your recommendations for like
my top 5? I love, and it can be a little pricey, but I love Tillandsia chiapensis, like Chiapas, but Chiapensis. And when I was on that trip, we were lucky enough to visit a canyon in Chiapas that had them growing naturally. It was just amazing to get to see on these cliff face walls. And that actually has a pinkish hue naturally all the time, not just when blooming, but is also kind of very gray and fuzzy like the Xerographica, a little bit smaller usually. Caput Medusae, that I mentioned earlier, is one of my absolute favorites. And one of the most tolerant of the kind of indoor environment there. They can be very drought resistant. And another thing people struggle with is it's often hard to tell to the untrained eye if your tillandsia are dry. The long kind of curly leaves, though, of the Caput Medusae, you can see a dramatic difference when they're dry versus when you've just watered them. So it's kind of an easier plant to gauge how dry it's become and when it needs water. And there's a really neat variety of that Caput Medusae purpurea, which has got a purplish tone to it all the time. That's quite gorgeous. Some really nice big ones. Latifolia is one of my favorites as well. It's kind of got green, spiky, large leaves. There's Juncias, which is a kind of very grassy-like look. And kind of everyone's probably most commonly seen beginner one is Ionantha. And those are kind of those cute little ones. And when used in mass, they can actually be really beautiful or even just one or two. Smaller plants, you got to be more careful about them drying out because they're sort of a smaller reservoir of water within them to hold on to. And that's why I kind of...
Yeah, you really got to be careful. I mean, even sometimes I had one rot where I let it dry upside down, but I didn't let it dry long enough.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that, you know, that was one of the main things that we thought about sort of when designing our display products was all of them, the plant is displayed completely suspended in air so that there's water, there's air movement on all sides when it's being displayed. And so often you'll see display techniques where it's, you know, in a shell or in some sort of a glass container or something whereby if there's water on the plant and it's pooling there, it's not going to dry. So we want to really create as much air circulation around that plant as possible at all times.
Mm-hmm. And I know this is a weird question. How do you know? So I do some plant styling on the side for friends. And one of my friends, I went over to her house and she was like, oh yeah, I have these air plants we could do something with. And it was a bowl of like the driest, crispiest, grayest, dead air plants I'd ever seen. But it kind of brought something up to me where I was like, well, are they dead? Like, should we soak them and see if they bounce back? But like, how do you know that it's actually dead? Because some of them kind of look dead just when they're dry.
I do. And that is a good question. We'll get a lot of people, it's very sad. They'll say, look at my beautiful air plant collection. I'm so excited. And I don't know if I have the heart to tell them that they're all dead.
Yeah, and, totally.
I would just say, well, one thing is often people will take the plants to the verge of death in terms of underwatering and then suddenly give them a really big soak and then the plant falls apart and dies. And they think it was the watering that killed it when in fact it was the long period of not watering. And so it wasn't necessarily the watering that killed it. It might have been the poor care leading up to that. But in general, even though many of them are green, there can often be like a grayish tone. Even though they are usually gray, you can see a little bit of green usually, and that can be an indicator that it's still alive. And I would say many species have somewhat pliable leaves where they'll bend a little bit. Some are normally rigid, but if the leaves have become very brittle, that's often a sign. And the number one sign is that kind of growing tip in the kind of the heart of it where the new leaves are emerging. If that turns brown or leaves just start falling out from the center there, it's over.
Right. Like when they
start. Yeah, exactly. If you kind of give it a gentle tug, basically, that's kind of a good way to put it. Just a very gentle tug.
Okay.
If leaves just fall off in your hand, then the plant's already died. But if it's got resistance, it might still have a chance.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. I'm so interested just to hear about like airplantman.com and the company and like all the cool things that you do with air plants and like where the inspiration and what your favorite product you have is and all the crazy.
It's been a really wild journey. And it's kind of funny. It just sort of started with this obsession. And then since then, kind of the next step just keeps appearing in front of us. And so, as I said, we started maybe 6-7 years ago. And we started with the air plant frame. And these are made from powder coated aluminum and hand strung stainless steel cable. And so the way we arrived at that was we wanted a really clean way to suspend a number of these plants and make them easy. And so the grid is You know, we looked at all sorts of, well, the first thing we thought about was care and the fact that to live, these plants are going to regularly need to get wet. And we would never want someone to have to remove them each time they watered it. And we wouldn't want to design mm-hmm. something that if it got wet all the time, it would fall apart. And so by using stainless steel cable and the powder coated aluminum, we created something that was 100% waterproof and also really lightweight. And so easy to take on and off the wall or move around your home and just sort of use. So, and then we wanted it to read both clean and intentional. We're not trying to hide the fact that we're doing a grid. That's why we didn't want to use kind of the fishing line or any of these other ways of sort of making it appear kind of that it's floating when it mm-hmm. isn't. So we used kind of a very kind of fine but intentional looking cable mesh. And then the reason we hand string it rather than using a welded wire mesh is it's both finer in texture and then also gives you some ability to change the size of the openings when you're inserting the plants. So for a big plant, you can sort of push it open a little bit more. Picture like a tennis racket that's a little bit easier to move the strings and then kind of secure it in place. And it is secured in place using no external fasteners, just the natural shape of the leaf. And so if you slide the plant in from the front of the frame, as the rear leaves begin to kind of pop open in the back, they're all kind of growing forward. And so it'll hook it into place. And so the only rule of thumb is you slide it in from the front and out through the back. Because if you pulled it out the front, you'd kind of rip off those bottom leaves. But it's amazingly easy to kind of get them all slid into place. Sometimes you'll trim a couple of those bottom leaves to the right length to make them easier to hook in. And then you can hold them upside down and give it a good shake and they're not going anywhere. And then the beauty of it is you either spray the frame with the plants in it, either over your sink or outside or on your wall if it's waterproof, or you can submerge the entire frame with the plants in it. And so it's actually quite fun. We've got our special dunking bins and you just drop the frame in and plants get really wet. And another fun detail I should have mentioned in the watering stage is it's really neat how the plants turn color when they get wet. You'll really see as those trichomes fall down, the vividness of the leaf really pops. And that's a good way to also tell if it's wet or dry and kind of how gray the leaf is. And so the frame was sort of designed to let people kind of plant their own picture, but in a much kind of lighter, easier, like the plant is better adapted to what you're trying to do to it way than in a lot of traditional vertical gardens. We didn't want to put bags of soil up on the wall. We wanted it to be really clean and minimal. Highlight what was unique about this plant, which is that it's floating in air. And so the idea is there's a transparency there that's both good for the air circulation, but also lets you recognize that there's something really special here. And it's that look of wonder when people realize this is a living plant that defies most of the things we assume about plants. And that sort of makes people take a fresh look at nature and kind of inspires that sense of wonder that's really, really fun and rewarding to see in people. And then the creative options are just so limitless. You can, because of all these different species that you can use, there's so many textures, colors, shapes, sizes, and you can create these kind of living artworks that can grow and change. And that's the last thing we love is it's not like you've got this heavy soil where you're having if a plant dies, you're looking at bare soil or a plastic container. If a plant dies, you simply slide it out and you're just looking right through it at the wall. Or if you have in front of a window, you get the transparency of light and air passing through these as well. And so this kind of living screen, living wall component was really neat. And quickly after we sort of developed that, we saw that now, these were fun as kind of individual standalone things. It's designed in a way to be used modularly. So you can kind of combine a number of these together and they have a very fine edge. So it starts to read as a group. And then they're so lightweight, you can suspend it just from a nail on the wall, just like a picture frame. And so it just seemed to really open up a lot of fun possibilities and may be good for the plants. We, through different hotel interactions, we had kind of requests that led us to develop another big component of our product line, which is the tabletop air plant vessel. And these have individual tillandsia that are hand wrapped in a waterproof wire, and they slide into different vessel bases that we've created out of powder coated steel, ceramics, wood. We've kind of experimented with a few different materials, but the core concept is the same, which is you have a single sculptural, beautiful plant above sort of a museum-like sculpture base. And this kind of highlights the amazing quality of each plant, whereas the kind of frame vertical garden, it gives you sort of this mass planting effect. And these vessels are really fun. When you do kind of a group of a bunch of them, it feels like the whole alien gang is hanging out. And there's just so much personality in these little guys. And when it comes time to water it, you just slide the plant with its wire out of the vessel, submerge it, and then you can slide it back in when it's done. And so both of these watering techniques, you never touch the plant, you just touch the design technique, and then it gets great air movement kind of while it's being displayed. And we found that been really helpful. So that's really been the driving goal, is showcase what's unique about these plants, have a clean design that's intentional, but not distracting to the plant. The plant is the star. And then finally, make sure it's sustainably made locally and good for the plants themselves, making it easy to keep them alive.
That's so cool. And do you sell air plants as well, or do you just
No, prefer... That's a good question. We started out with no air plants and then pretty quickly realized how sad it would be to get a display technique with no plants. And so all our products include plants, and we offer booster kits, refreshes if it's needed. And yeah, everything comes fully planted, ready to go. And we even ship our frames now fully planted so that you open the box, hang it on the wall, and it's ready to go. We've got fun kind of monthly clubs too, if you want some new plants to arrive each month, whatever's coming into bloom at the moment.
Ooh, exactly.
Air Plants of the Month Club is good. And new things are always coming into bloom. And so you can kind of rotate kind of a few new flowers, or you go to the store and you pick up a new plant, you can sort of put it in your frame. It's a great way. I had plants scattered all over my apartment, and when it came time to water, it was really challenging because you had to gather them all up and it was kind of a pain. When they all live in one place, it's both aesthetically pretty striking and then really easy to water because you just got one thing that carries them all around.
Right, just done.
And then the custom projects has just been really fun. We get architects and designers from all over kind of come to us with different conditions and challenges and ideas, and sort of collaborating with them to create unique installations has been really rewarding. And we've gotten a chance to work with the W Hotel and the Starbucks Reserve, both in Waikiki and Palm Springs.
Yes,
it was
wonderful.
Their design team reached out to me, and we did two really unique installations with them. One in Waikiki. It was great to finally get to use my Hawaiian Tillandsia source, and we cleaned her out. And
tough life having to go to Hawaii to...
It's hard. Someone's got to do it. And Palm Springs, we did rely quite a bit on the Big Zero Graphicas because of how dry and difficult that condition is. And the challenge is always, how do you create a sustainable installation in these kind of challenging locations? Whether we've developed automatic irrigation systems, we often will either maintain these installations ourselves or find a local partner to do so. And one of our strategies for kind of larger installations at hotels are often sort of rotating. So, rather than a cut flower, which has a lifespan and dies, if every few weeks you sort of rotate two sets of plants, one that's back in the nursery, kind of getting ideal light and air, and then one sort of in whatever dark, miserable location they wanted to display it in. As long as you get it out of there within a few weeks, the plant can bounce back and be healthy and not die. And so there's a nice way of sort of preserving. You're not just throwing everything out. But when we are able to design built-in irrigation, it is just amazing how much they thrive and how little care they end up needing. We've had some installations be in for a year or two with maybe one or two out of 1,000 plants needing to be swapped. And so that's really neat. And we even designed a mobile screen system, series of these 4 8-foot-tall installations on a rooftop in West Hollywood. And it had a built-in watering system, built-in lights and misters even. And so it was just, they were constantly having events up in this space. And so they were always needing to kind of set it up and take it down. And so these gigantic wheeled walled screen things were one of the more fun outlandish things we got to design. And it's really fun. It's, as a landscape architect myself, I'm very familiar with sort of the design process and all the different components that go into it. But it's actually a lot of fun to suddenly become the really specialized consultant and just sort of come in and work with people on this one component of it.
Yeah, the niche within the niche.
just like the Tillandsia, I guess, we've become pretty specialized. But it's just a really fun plant in general, I would say. It has its unique care requirements, and it definitely takes some getting used to kind of appreciate all of those. Hopefully, shared some tips that'll help your listeners today. But I would always just say, you know, don't be discouraged and try to learn from what might have gone wrong in the past. And don't consider these carefree. But if you do find the right care regimen or situation, they can be virtually carefree. I'll just share one little anecdote. I had some plant that I was doing everything I could to keep alive and it died. And afterwards, I found another plant had sort of fallen behind the potting table and was like living like on the ground behind it in the dark. That one was thriving. So the plants will often almost mock you in how challenging they can be. And then at other times will be totally indestructible. So you have to sort of accept the challenge and that there will be unpredictable components, but it makes it all the more rewarding when it goes right.
100%. And that's part of plant parenthood. That's like part of it is just experiencing and blooming and growing and learning with the plant.
Good way to put it. It's a living hobby. It's not, it's never done and it's never perfect.
I love that.
But that's why it's fun.
So where can we find you? Everybody should follow Josh on Instagram because your installations and your photos of the of what you do with air plants is so wild.
You.
So where can we find you?
Definitely check us out at AirPlantMan on Instagram and Facebook and AirPlantMan.com. Very easy. So word air, plant, and man, just as one long word. My old Hotmail address still now officially registered trademark. And if you Google that anywhere, you can find us and, you know, more information on sort of the brand and all our products is available on the website. And we ship all over the country and even the world. So feel free to let us know any questions. Yeah.
Thank you so much to Josh. His info will be in the show notes. I really do feel like I'm falling in love with air plants in such a deeper way now that I live in Florida. And I hope this episode has you fall in love with air plants just a little bit more as well. They're such great additions to so many little nooks and crannies in your house if you can have them. And if you followed me on Instagram, maybe you saw that I did a whole Thanksgiving fall tablescape with these live trends like planters that had air plants in them, and they look so cute and they make such great gifts too. So anyway, check out Josh, check out an air plant, and of course, my plant friends, keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.